Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and of course we will be hearing from Adam Boileau in just a moment, and we'll be talking through all the week's security news. And then of course we're going to hear from this week's sponsor. Jonathan Reiber is this week's sponsor guest. He is the Senior Director of Cybersecurity at AttackIQ, and he's joining us to talk through the US government's executive order on Zero Trust. Jonathan says that order is actually born of a realization that the US government needs to do something differently, that the old approaches aren't working. AttackIQ makes an attack and breach simulation platform, and yeah, they're big on zero trust validation right now for obvious reasons. So that is this week's sponsor interview with Jonathan Reiber, coming up after the news section with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, bit of movement this week on various countries signaling that they are going to use military agencies against ransomware crews. We've seen comments from the head of the NCSC in the UK. We've seen the Dutch saying something similar. And then just today, Australia dropped some ransomware action plan thing that talks a lot about how ASD can be used to disrupt various plans. So, you know, it certainly looks like a lot of countries are now signaling that if they get whacked big time with a big attack, they're going to respond with military agencies.
Which has been a long time coming. You know, we've been talking around, you know, about the Hound releasing for a while on the show, and you know, the wheels are starting to turn a bit there. I mean, the fact that we were willing to tolerate attacks on hospitals during a global pandemic, you know, obviously I think has, you know, pushed this along a bit, but yeah, I mean, it does sound like things are getting real. And whether this will actually shift the needle at all, you know, for ransomware crews until we see some, you know, because it's one thing to have, you know, have a capability. It's another thing to threaten to use the capability. But, you know, when you actually go ahead and make it clear that you will, that you actually do use it and can be seen, because, I mean, you know, I'm always thinking about the, you know, the classic doomsday device on Dr. Strangelove. Like, you have to tell the other people that you have a doomsday device to get the deterrence value. And in many respects, you know, the willingness of governments to use the tools of the military against criminal civilians, we don't really know what that's going to look like. And they have to go and kind of show that they can, they will, and what that looks like and what that means for them to make it real.
Well, you're right, because it is still all talk, right, at this point.
So as much as we can, a little bit of Dutch, you know, Dutch action.
Oh man, AIVD versus Black Matter, round one, fight. Can't wait for that one, right? Like, that'll be a lot of fun. But I guess the point is, like, I don't think it's been said this explicitly in the past. And when you're looking at a, you know, in the case of the Australian one today, well, I mean, it's just spelled out there. It's completely plainly written. What's really funny, though, is we often associate the United States with being a country that tends to use its military in a really aggressive way, and they're the laggards here, which is it's actually kind of surprising.
Yeah, it is a kind of strange situation to see countries, you know, UK, US, you know, some
those
European
military
nations.
Aggressors, the Dutch, you know, like, what?
Yeah, exactly. You know, seeing them out ahead of the US. And, you know, in some respects, that's because the US, in my opinion, because the US kind of understands this game really well. And they do, you know, they have perhaps more concerns, more to lose, perhaps, than some of the other countries. They're certainly, if you get a feeling that they're thinking about it more, you know.
I just think it's a bunch of nervous people in the State Department who are pulling the brakes on it, or I don't know. I don't get why they're so reluctant. I mean, clearly, you know, as we spoke about last week, Nakasone's ready to go on the cyber command end. Like, you know, just give me the word. Seems to be the vibe, but it seems like
the cyber cigar into the role.
Yeah, exactly. So it just seems like the reluctance is coming more from the politicians than from the agencies, right? So,
and I could certainly see how it would kind of, you know, mess up the State Department's day when you're trying to have a conversation with Russia about State Department things at the same time that
you're committing, you know, computer crimes in Russia, essentially.
Yeah, exactly right. And there's the cyber equivalent of a, you know, Black Hawk, stealth Black Hawk cybering into some.
Oh man, Black Hawk metaphors. This is awesome.
You know, I don't know what the cyber equivalent of fast roping down is, but yeah, whatever it is that cyber command.
A cyber SEAL does. Team. Let's go there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I get it. I think that goes some way to explaining the reluctance there is that, yeah, it's going to complicate your day. If you're a State Department official who deals with Russia and all of a sudden you've got a whole bunch of salty Russian officials talking about how America's hacking computers in Russia and it's a military incursion and in the Fifth Domain and blah, 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 blah. So yeah, no, I get it. But it is really interesting seeing the Brits and the Dutch and the Australians being more aggressive than the Americans. I do find it a little bit upside down.
Yeah, it'll be funny to see whether there's any kind of consequence to that, like whether, you know, we see nationalist Russians, you know, kind of taking umbrage at that and refocusing, or whether they just don't care because, hey, you make money wherever you can make money and, you know, Aussie dollars good as American dollars.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been a ransomware attack. One of the crews hit, like, Macquarie Healthcare here in Australia last week, and I think there's been some other attacks against aged care facilities. Like, it feels like it's kind of kicking off here properly. So, thankfully, the government's arrived with a plan just kind of in time. Not that it helps all the people who got rinsed last year. Meanwhile, in the United States, Kevin Collier for NBC reports that more grain distributors in the US have been hit. So we spoke about that one, I think, what were they called? New Cooperative in Iowa. There's been another two, Farmers Cooperative and Crystal Valley from Minnesota got hit as well. So, but it looks like it's not really going to disrupt the food supply chain or anything, but it is still a critical sector that they're targeting here.
It certainly is a critical sector, and I mean the fact that the grain industry in the US is so big and can perhaps absorb whatever disruption, I mean that's nice, but you know this is, you know, food production is still very much critical infrastructure, even at, you know, kind of less than national scale. Some of the questioning we've seen about this is whether there's any kind of common origin point here, like three companies in basically the same industry being hit in short succession. Like, is there a supply chain aspect? Is there a, you know, is it coincidence? Like whether or not there are, that's a thing that some crew has found a niche, you know, found the bug in some
grain, you know, supply software management or software, or
yeah,
something.
Some, yeah, you know, some nasty Java app or whatever that does that. I mean, you know, there's plenty of sectors that do have niche software that has never been looked at from a security perspective before. So whether that's in play, we don't know. I guess we'll see if there's any more get hit or whether it's just coincidence.
Meanwhile, Mandiant's dropped a paper on a group it calls Fin12, which is targeting organizations with a turnover of $300 million, which and they seem pretty keen on hitting healthcare concerns, hospitals, things like that, which, you know, just what a bunch of jerks. Let's just say that.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty nasty, especially, you know, in this time, pretty nasty thing to be doing. On the other hand, I guess if other ransomware operators have said we're not going to target healthcare, then, you know, you get higher market share or something. So, like, maybe it's...
But that's why it's sort of futile. I mean, we said this at the time that Biden gave his list of, like, you know, don't attack these things. I mean, you're just leaving that space wide open for another crew to come in, and maybe these guys are it.
Yeah, exactly. With the, you know, the sort of Russian criminals that don't respect cyber norms. You
know, yeah.
The ones that extra don't respect them, as to just, you know, a little bit don't respect
the Kaiser Soze's of ransomware. They'll just go that little bit further. Let's finish talking about ransomware, because it does feel like we've been having the same conversation over and over and over. It's doing my head in a little bit. But yeah, there has been some movement. Let's wait for the next big one in the UK, Australia, or in the Netherlands, and let's see what the response is like, or even the United States. But I feel like, you know, we might actually see some movement on this. What else have we got? We got Iran-based hackers doing credential spraying against O365 accounts, and it's not till you get to the end of this story that you read that it's through AutoDiscover and ActiveSync, which is like, ActiveSync is so old. Can we not?
Like,
can we just
2004
not?
Tech. Yeah, I thought the same thing. You know, ActiveSync, that's kind of old. Why, you know, didn't seem super interesting. And then you read the targeting kind of Nexi, the targeting Nexus for these. And it's, according to Microsoft, the group that Microsoft attribute this to have been observed targeting defense companies in the US, EU, and Israel, producing military-grade radars, drone technology, satellite systems, emergency response communication systems, GIS systems, spatial analytics, and regional ports of entry in the Persian Gulf. So
that's who's using ActiveSync, I guess. So everything's fine, I mean, you know?
Nothing important, right?
And Google, in the same vein, they issued email notifications to 14,000 Gmail users about apparently APT28 doing a bulk phishing campaign. Which is, you know, Google's good at this stuff, though.
They are. And, you know, I guess people take it a bit more seriously when it comes from Google. That, you know, hey, we've seen government-sponsored attackers, you know, attempting to target you. That's, you know, it's a useful reminder for journalists and activists and whoever else, and kind of pushes them towards using the Google's advanced security program, of which I think they are giving out security keys to a bunch of people as well. So kind of nice timing on that. But yeah, Fancy Bear taking a pretty broad brush set of targets on
14,000. I mean, it's borderline cheeky at that point, isn't it? It's like, wow, have you guys got to hit your KPIs or something? Like, what's the go?
Maybe they're just trying to keep Google Tag busy. Like they're doing something else sneaky somewhere else. And so like, let's just go wind up Tag, you know, tarp it them down with a whole bunch of stuff. And then while we go to the, like the one account that actually matters on the other side of the network.
Yeah, there seemed to be a lot of sad pandas on Twitter who didn't get the notification too because they're not important enough to get targeted by the Russians. But aww, you're right too. Google is giving away 10,000 U2F security keys to journalists, elected officials and human rights activists.
Yeah, which definitely a good move. You know, Google has been doing quite a lot of work to try and make their products as robust as possible. And obviously, you know, there's a marketing benefit to this. Like they've been pushing security as a brand positioning thing for a while. Like there's, you know, bus stop ads, you know, around the place saying how good Google's email security is. So, you know, I guess they need to follow through lest it goes wrong for them.
Well, I mean, it's good that they are, right? So
it is good.
That is cool. Now, look, we're going to talk about a story that's not a cyber story, although it does have a cyber dimension. God, we say cyber a lot these days. I never would have thought we would, but here we are. A bloke and his wife in the United States got arrested for trying to sell state secrets, specifically involving nuclear submarines, like information about Virginia-class nuclear submarines, to an unnamed country. A lot of people say it's France. France has denied it, but, you know, it kind of feels like maybe the French. But yeah, what makes this really interesting and something worth us talking about, and CyberScoop kind of gets this as well, right, with their story here, because they've written this up as espionage in the digital age, right? What's amazing about this is the guy who got arrested, his OPSEC, and this also was a bit weird because the New York Times specifically wrote a story about how bad his OPSEC was. But when you read the story, his OPSEC was actually very good. He just made one absolutely catastrophic, critical and dumb mistake, which is why he is now in prison.
Yes, so he was, amongst other things, communicating with the foreign, well, who he believed to be a foreign intelligence service, but turned out to be the FBI, via like public Wi-Fi and then Tor to Proton Mail, and he was asking for payment in Monero, which, you know, seems pretty best practice, I guess, these days for, you know, trying to sneak around the network. So, you know, some good technical OPSEC there. And as you say, some of his more trad espionage OPSEC, a little less than perfect.
Well, the funny thing is, and, you know, we were just on our internal Slack, we were talking about this when the story first landed. And as soon as I read it, I'm like, my God, he was letting the other party pick the dead drop locations ahead of time. Like, what, you know, there's even transcripts in the complaint where he's like, oh, I'm not too keen on you picking the dead drop location, you know, because what if you're the FBI? You could like totally see me and stuff. And yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, maybe should have read a few more, you know, like classic 1970s Cold War spy novels and, you know.
Yeah, the she'll be right attitude doesn't really work when you're selling state secrets. but this brings up an interesting question, right? Which is, say he would have picked dead drop sites ahead of time, dropped the stuff there ahead of time, you know, months ahead of time, because he was dropping encrypted files. And then he was basically taking cryptocurrency payments in exchange for the keys. So he actually did think about this. Like the way he did this technically was actually quite interesting. But if he had to put this stuff out there, you know, for months ahead of the time and then just, you know, sold them the location of the drop with the keys, you know, he might not have got caught, right? Which is what I think is interesting.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, those listeners that are, you know, listening to Risky Biz for tips on how to sell secrets, Pat's provided the details. At one point, I think he had what was like a micro SD card inside a peanut butter sandwich or something. Yeah. That was one of the other details of reporting, which, you know.
Which isn't much good when you've got, you know, half the FBI there with telephoto lenses. Like, I mean, it's just amazing when you read his comments to these people where he's like, yeah, no, I mean, I'm not really keen for you to pick the dead drop sites. But how he came to trust them was he asked them, thinking it was a different country, to like show a flag or do a signal from their embassy. And they did because they were cooperating with the FBI. And apparently that was good enough for him. But even then, if you're selling state secrets to another government, why would you want them to know who you are? You know, like this just doesn't make any sense at all. Like, I just can't believe that he went through all the hoo-ha with like .onion sites to Proton Mail and public Wi-Fi and, you know, good use of PGP or GPG or whatever he was using, you know, does all of that and then says, yeah, okay, I'm going to turn up at this time and place that you nominate. Like what?
It is in some respects like pretty classic nerd, like getting all the technology stuff right and then screwing up the meat space, you know,
because
yeah.
Anyway, so it is interesting. And this is a thing that's peculiar to, or that's specific rather to US criminal complaints, is they're often quite fun to read. You've noticed that, right?
Yes. Yeah, they are.
Like criminal complaints in Australia and New Zealand are not fun to read.
Dry and boring.
Dry and boring. Yeah, FBI. You know, they write it. They write a good one. So yeah, do check out the actual complaint. If you feel like a bit of light reading, it's not so bad. It's a very interesting case study, I guess, into modern espionage. Now we move to the least surprising news I think we've spoken about for a while. This comes from Joseph Mann and Christopher Bing over at Reuters. The headline is, hackers of SolarWinds stole data on US sanctions policy, intelligence probes. Gee, I wonder why Russians would be interested in US sanctions policy or intelligence probes. That's mind-blowing.
Yes, so they looked into some of the things that the actors were doing once they had got in through the SolarWinds attack and then the subsequent kind of lateral movement up into the Microsoft environments. And yeah, sure enough, looking for things like sanctions and other stuff that's of interest to Russians and the Russian government. So yeah, I mean,
alternative headline, like, Russian spies targeted exactly what you'd expect them to.
Exactly. And I mean, if anything, it does strengthen the argument that this was just normal espionage and nothing particularly out of the ordinary or beyond norms, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a good sign that they're annoyed enough about the sanctions to go and want to collect intel on them too.
Yeah, right? I guess suggests that they are perhaps useful for something. They are perhaps working a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, look, we've got this whole raft of stories and I know in front of us now, all of a similar theme. We got, what, 3 from The Record. We got 1 from The Washington Post, 1 from Cyberscoop. And they're all about new, like, task forces, regulations or legislation that's coming in the United States. Tom Uren is going to write a little bit more on this for our newsletter tomorrow. But this ties into what we were talking about last week, which is it really does feel like there's quite a sustained push from the US government at the moment to get stuff done in the cybersecurity field, right?
Yeah, it's certainly been given a bunch of priority and we are starting to see the benefits of that, you know, sort of begin to, you know, show up. A lot of the stuff still needs to, you know, make its way through the US process. But, you know, we are seeing
the human centipede that is US lawmaking.
Yes, it's a little bit slow, but it'll get there in the end. But yes, we've got legislation, you know, the stuff talking about having to divulge ransomware payments and kind of some details about time frames and what sorts of organizations, you know, in terms of size of number of employees that would apply to. We've got some talking about improved cryptocurrency enforcement, like starting up teams to focus on money laundering and cryptocurrency and that kind of thing, kind of build out some of the, you know, actual, you know, people, bodies that they need to, you know, go target ransomware, crypto management, go, you know, build some quality oversight of the cryptocurrency world, like accepting it's going to happen and then go deal with, you know, the actual boring regulatory reality of making cryptocurrency exchanges do the things right.
Well, but I mean, this is specifically about investigating bad stuff. So this is the National Cryptocurrency Enforcement Team at the Department of Justice. And it was announced by the Deputy Attorney General, right? So this feels like it could be a real thing.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Like, there's just a lot of, you know, there is some way to go from the, like, this is a, you know, the cyberspace delirium saying, hey, this is a thing we should do. And now they're actually starting to put the, you know, mechanics in place to be able to go and, you know, investigate money laundering.
It's just weird though, business, isn't it? Because we've been doing this a long time and normally there's a big government report, right, written on what should we do about the cybers, and it winds up being locked in a drawer and everyone forgets about it. But it looks like, you know, a lot of this stuff is now trickling out into the real world.
Which is a good thing. And clearly, you know, we're at the point where, you know, the US government, you know, does take a while sometimes to get moving, but they are moving, you know.
Well, there's this other thing too, and I thought this one was really interesting, is the DOJ is going to go after government contractors that don't report breaches, and they're going to hit them under the False Claims Act. So this is something the DOJ is going to be pursuing under what they're calling their Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative, right? So, I mean, that's pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in the business of supplying the US government services and you're making claims about how secure it is and, you know, putting padlocks and shields, you know, in your marketing material, then, yeah, you may well be looking down the barrel of actually having to deliver some of that stuff. And if you get breached, if you have problems, you don't do best practice, then, yeah, you may see the wrong end of the
litigation. Of the DOJ. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And meanwhile, the TSA is imposing cybersecurity standards on things like rail and subway systems. Is that right?
Yes, so, you know, expanding the, well, we've seen the kind of list of what's critical infrastructure and what's super extra, hyper, mega critical infrastructure.
Super duper.
super duper critical. And yeah, obviously big transportation and, you know, big bulk freight transportation, rails obviously used a lot for that, is super important. So yeah, this is kind of looking at the sorts of things they did for the pipeline operators, and looking at, you know, what other sectors regulated by the TSA, you know, are also things they should care about. The funny thing is the rail sector has come out and said, well, you know, we've kind of been doing all these things for a long time, so we don't really need regulation, which is, you know, that's a thing we've heard before.
Yeah.
If you're already doing all these things, then what's the problem?
Exactly.
So there was a little bit of protesting there.
Don't make us actually document it, because we might find gaps that we have to do something about.
Heaven forbid.
Also, the Office of Management and Budget has put out a memo ordering federal agencies to let CISA access information about how devices are protected and things like that. As I say, like, we don't need to go super deep on this, but there's just a lot happening.
There really is. And if you're, you know, the sort of person that's responsible for doing compliance stuff for, you know, either government agencies or suppliers to government agencies at the moment, I imagine you're going to have a really busy, you know, kind of year, couple of years dealing with all this change. There's going to be a lot of work to do. And, you know, this is all useful work. I mean, the idea that CISA would come in, you know, to other federal agencies and go look at, you know, whether or not they've got their endpoint security stuff configured correctly, like, that does seem genuinely useful.
Yeah.
Given how many federal agencies have gotten popped.
I mean, if CISA's got bandwidth to deal with it, but, you know, that's their problem. Yes. Doesn't mean this shouldn't happen. Let's change gear again. We got a story here from Joseph Cox in Vice Motherboard. And it's one of those stories that, you know, people love to write up about who InQtel funds, right? So InQtel apparently kicked 1.6 mil to Wika, which makes a lot of sense, actually, because Wika is used heavily by the US federal government. Like, a lot of federal government agencies use it as a secure communications platform, right? And often InQtel will sponsor funding or organize money for companies that the US government deals with so that they can build features or whatever like that. So, you know, this is written up a little bit like, oh, you know, this is sus that the CIA is giving, you know, money to an E2EE platform. But, you know, it absolutely makes sense. But I guess why I'm interested in this story is because Joe Cox, who wrote the story, points out that it's quite a popular app with organized criminals, right? So we're in this really weird position where InQtel, which, I mean, everyone writes up as like the CIA investment arm, but it's actually bigger than that these days. It's like much more across government, you know, security agencies, of course, but yeah, it's not just CIA anymore. But it is kind of weird when you got the US government sort of funding app features for an app used heavily by the government that is also benefiting organized crime.
It is a funny kind of dual use scenario, but I mean, not without precedent. I mean, the, you know, the historical origins of Tor.
Yeah, that was Navy, you know, grants.
Yes, exactly right. So we've seen this happen before. What I actually didn't realize, I didn't realize that Wika had been bought by Amazon. That was the thing I took away from this article that was surprising. I mean, you know, InQtel splashing money around, and 1.6 mil is not a whole heap in the scheme of things. But yeah, I didn't realize it got sold to Amazon. I didn't realize that Wika had an actual business model either, of like selling, you know, like managed government logged centralized crypto messaging.
Yeah, but I mean, Wika, you know, Signal got the consumer market, right? So if you needed something with those enterprise features, it was pretty much Wika or nothing. And the US government's been on that trip with them for a while, right? But yeah. But what's funny is, like, a lot of the time journalists write these stories as in, oh, it's shady, you know, InQtel's paying them to subvert the service. And, you know, that's not what it is. But what if it is in this case? That'd be funny.
I mean, I guess it could be both, right? They can improve it for government whilst also subverting it for criminals. And at the very least, like writing it up like this, if you're a criminal that uses Wika right now, maybe you want to reevaluate your threat modeling.
Yeah, I mean, I totally thought the same thing, right? Which was that it had undermined confidence a bit. If you were some mafia person reading this article, you'd probably go, yeah, maybe we don't want to use the CIA-sponsored platform.
Anyway. That's good. I guess, you know, kind of naturally segmenting the market a little bit. That makes sense.
Now, speaking of the CIA, and I guess we'd have a few listeners there in the CIA cybers. So hello, you're not going to enjoy this one because we're going to be talking about Vault 7. And Joshua Schulte, who, as you know, he's the alleged Vault 7 leaker, and we've spoken about this guy quite a lot. We got a story here from Zach Dorfman at Yahoo News talking about the roadblocks that case has hit. It looks like it's heading for a retrial, but it's been delayed. And Schulte is like, I mean, he strikes me as being a very loose unit, but he's also someone who's very good at making everyone's life hard, which I think is going to serve him quite well in this case, because he's like demanding information. He's demanding access to all the information he allegedly stole. And there's a lot more apparently that he stole that didn't make it into the Vault 7 dumps. So he's asking, well, you say I stole this stuff, give me a copy of it. And this is a guy who's notorious for leaking to media and stuff and to WikiLeaks, etc. So they don't want to give him this stuff. And he's just making life real interesting for the DOJ.
I read this because we covered the earlier kind of mistrial that happened, and he's representing himself, and he's, you know, there's just a bunch of things that were, you know, you saw how that trial was going. You're like, this is just going to be a mess. And obviously the prosecution does seem to have also kind of made a bit of a mess of it. And, you know, it's going to go back to trial now. And, you know, this is, as you said, like the guy who'd been like leaking stuff to the media from a cell phone smuggled into prison. And then like the sheer cheek of saying, you are claiming that there is forensic evidence on CIA servers that I took this information. I, as the defense, have the right to investigate that. Please give me forensic disk images of the CIA's CIA servers filled with presumably other stuff that he didn't steal. And then what? He's going to sit in prison with his, you know, like smuggled in cell phone and have access to classified data. Like, I mean, is there a skiff in the prison? Like, the sheer cheek of it.
If you just want to gum up the works, like you do stuff like this. And this guy, I mean, let's see. He might walk, right? Which would just be incredible, wouldn't it?
I mean, it would. And, I mean, you don't want to, under no circumstances do you got to hand it to them. But, I mean, you kind of got to hand it to him. Like, if you're going to tarp it up the works, I mean, you know, what he's in, like, Rikers Island or whatever, and they're going to build him a skiff to look at CIA disk. I mean, like, it's just ludicrous.
Yeah,
And, yeah, he might actually just walk.
Yeah, it's lawfare as practiced by an amateur, and it's, you know, it's a sight to beheld. Catalin Kimpanu for The Record reports that police in Ukraine have arrested a DDoS botnet operator, 100,000 bots. Nothing particularly interesting there, but that's not the only botnet news we got this week. This one I found cool, right? Someone, this is based on a con talk. They did a talk at the Virus Bulletin 2021 conference, and they looked at a botnet that abused like TP-Link LTE routers to send dodgy SMSs, right? So people were discovering this thing because they were getting like, you know, gigantic bills. But this botnet's been around for a few years, and I was just like, huh, this one's actually kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's genuinely interesting. So they were using like some like access control flaw in the web interface where you could like hit the like read and write SMS and read and write the address book and other configuration endpoints in the web interface, you know, kind of without auth. And yeah, they just scanned the internet for that particular model and then built some kind of, you know, service on top, API on top of it. And then I think we're just selling it as like a cut price SMS delivery service using a botnet of, you know, LTE routers. They weren't even really hacked. It was like, it was, you know, it's not really authed properly. You know, like not like remote code exact. Although I'm sure there was RC and nasty old TP links. But anyway, yeah, they just built a service on top and sold it. And, you know, some of the messages that are being sent are, you know, quite plausibly legitimate, but just kind of, you know, they're undercutting the regular operators' SMS gateways and off you go, which, I mean, but that's innovative.
That's a model. Yeah. I didn't realize they hadn't actually compromised the devices, but what you're saying makes sense, right? They just, you know, figure out a way to do it every time they need to send a message.
Yeah. It's just an API. You build a front end on it, you whack a queue on it, and now you've got a product, right? I mean, we've seen the same thing done with voicemail systems or PABX systems for calling. So, yeah, why not do it for SMS?
Looks like someone fired up a test attack using their new botnet against Azure and Microsoft mitigated it, but it was 2.4 terabits per second.
So that's a lot of UDP. They said it was targeting some customer in Azure in Europe. They didn't specify more details. But yeah, I mean, 2.4 terabits, that's a lot of packets. And I mean, good for Microsoft for syncing it, I guess.
Yeah, was this some sort of reflection attack or we don't know?
I don't know. We've seen any details about what the actual packet payloads look like, but I mean,
you'd think it'd have to be, right? Like with that, at that sort of volume.
This is a lot of packets. So I don't know. I mean, we'll see if they point their cannons at someone else now that they've tested it or, you know, figure out they can't hit Azure.
Amnesty International has released a report. This one's from Andrea Peterson at The Record that has linked an Indian company to spyware that targeted an activist in Togo. I just think this is interesting because, you know, we saw that stuff from the Reuters team about that company in India, Beltrox, right? Yeah, Beltrox. So it looks like there's a bit of an industry in India that does, you know, makes these sorts of tools and does a bit of shady stuff. So this will be one to keep an eye on to see if the, you know, proliferation is really going to kick off in India, I think.
Yeah, this particular company was called Inafu Labs, and they have come out and said that they weren't associated with what had been previously kind of tracked as the Donut team, a bunch of tools and techniques used against political targets and things in Togo. So yeah, they said they had no particular tie to it, but then again, you know, they're hardly going to say, yes, that was totally us. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of really smart software devs in India, and you know, there's a lot of them, so the idea that they would be in this market makes total sense. I mean, it's kind of where you would expect to see, you know, that kind of confluence of really great technical skills and, you know, not a whole bunch of oversight and regulation in the same way that we would see out here in the Five Eyes.
Yeah, yeah. Twitch, about this time last week, actually, Twitch got owned. I think it was about this time last week. Anyway, we didn't talk about it last week. Twitch got owned, but it looks like, and you know, it's been all over the news. I'm sure everybody's seen it by now. I think the most interesting thing that got leaked was how much the streamers were getting paid, which really surprised a lot of people because some of these people make a lot of money, right?
They do. They
An absolute bunch of money. But it looks like, and Twitch, of course, is owned by Amazon, so it's been a pretty tough time for them, I'm guessing, dealing with this. But it looks like they're still trying to kick these attackers out and they're dealing with defacements and stuff, and it's a bit of a mess.
Yeah, it certainly is. The nature of the leak was pretty broad. Like, there was a whole bunch of source code, bunch of tooling, bunch of internal stuff from inside Twitch, plus, you know, a whole lot of data dumped around the place. And we've seen, you know, people digging into that. Obviously, you know, financial stuff, like how much the streamers make, was interesting. But we've seen people doing, like, you know, like AWS config reviews, kind of unsolicited AWS config reviews, looking through their source, you know, and kind of writing commentary on Twitter about, you know, how their stuff's configured and what's going on, and doing the sort of, you know, things that a professional security review would do. And so, you know, now that the source is out there and people can see all of the internal kind of AWS plumbing and APIs and various things, there's all sorts of opportunities for people to go and, you know, do a, you know, white box security review, find the places where key material is used badly or where APIs aren't secured or whatever else. And I think Twitch will be, you know, facing a pretty long tail of people using things they've learned from being able to see the inside of that infrastructure to then help themselves with stuff. Like, we, for example, we saw someone had replaced like banner images on a bunch of game pages with like a close-up picture of Jeff Bezos's eyeballs.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there'll be a bunch of that sort of thing going on.
So you reckon this might just be people who are using stuff dumped by the original attackers rather than this being directly tied to the original attack?
Yeah, I think this is just because now you can see it. You can go find a bunch of bugs or a bunch of misconfigurations. I mean, for example, there was a bug in their password authentication flow where at some point they upgraded from like salted SHA-1s to bcrypts or whatever it was. And the login flow had a logic bug where you could log in with the literal SHA-1 hash because of the way that it checked before it did the upgrade. And that's the sort of bug that you'd find in someone's auth flow, you know, in any site if you went and read the source. But of course, now that bug's been there for years and turns out that, yeah, you could have, you didn't have to crack passwords stolen from Twitch to be able to log in. So people finding that kind of edge case bug, you know, that, like, they're getting a crowdsourced security review, you know, for very little cost.
So the glass half full view, I guess, is that they're going to come out the other side of this in a better place. Hooray.
Well, I mean, well, yeah, right. I mean, they got all of InfoSec Twitter, you know, wanting to rub their nose in it, but at the same time, that's going to improve the quality of their service. And, you know, once they get over the pain, I mean, they will be probably the most robust.
It's funny, right? Because, you know, there are people on YouTube, people on Twitch making a lot of money, but I don't get why people are surprised by that, right? You look at some of the audiences, they're bigger than top rating TV programs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. And I mean, certainly Twitch has monetized that as a platform, has done well at kind of monetizing that sort of engagement, you know, much better than a bunch of other platforms. Well, maybe we should Twitch stream the show.
Yeah, I was thinking that, man. Looking at some of those numbers, I'm like, yeah, you know, let's be Twitch.
Take donations, it'd be amazing.
What else have we got here? This next story, this is a big deal because Microsoft is disabling XL 4.0 macros. And, you know, Catalan's written it up for the record here, so that's the version we're going off. If people only knew, I'm sure a lot of listeners do know, but if people only knew, like, how much carnage XL4 macros, like a 20-year-old format that is still respected by modern Office that just rinses endpoints, you know, that's all, you know, most macro-based malware uses it now. And I just can't believe it's taken this long to finally deprecate it. But this is a good thing.
It's 30 years. XL4 was 1992, so we're at 29 years.
Wow.
which is, yeah, that's pretty wild. But yes, Microsoft finally is releasing a plan to begin deprecating it. You can, of course, turn it off yourself if you admin a network and you don't want to use spreadsheets that were written in 1994 that run your business. Then yeah, you could probably turn those off. But yes, Microsoft's got a plan. It will get rolled out gradually. And yeah, I mean, a lot of people got a lot of owned. Interestingly enough, it did take a while for the Excel macro technique to really kind of get picked up. Like we kind of, you know, went backwards. People were using the VB later, you know, subsequent VB macros were a bit more popular originally. But yeah, we've seen a real uptick in the use of that, of the classic Excel technique in more recent years. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, had a resurgence of interest, which is why people these days care about a 30-year-old macro format. But yeah, Microsoft doing a good thing.
Yeah, they are. But I mean, you agree that this is actually going to be quite disruptive to a whole bunch of malware crews because this is their standard deployment technique.
Yes, yeah. I mean, anything that makes the office less prone to remote, you know, to arbitrary code execution is absolutely going to make their lives difficult. And Microsoft did add support to the AMSI, like script scanning interface, so that the macros being executed by Excel would get ingested by the AMSI monitoring. I think that was earlier this year. But yeah, turning it off does seem a little bit easier.
Yeah, I'm just sort of disappointed it's taken this long, right? Microsoft is so scared to break backwards compatibility with 30-year-old macro formats when they're just, I mean, why not just turn it off by default for everyone? I just think, you know, it's good that they're doing this, but why did it take so long, you know?
Well, I mean, what percentage of the world's economy runs on Excel spreadsheets written in the 90s, right? I mean, it's probably a few.
Just stop. Just stop. Oh God, Azure, GitHub, GitLab, and Bitbucket have done a mass revocation of SSH keys because a tool named Gitkraken has been generating these keys and doing so with pretty piss poor entropy, apparently. So no option but to do mass revocation. So that's going to make life fun for a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, and it's kind of nice to see this. It's kind of a good news story in a way. I mean, A, the bug was discovered in-house by the people who make the software. B, they managed to fix it and then coordinate, you know, a bunch of the big Git operators to revoke the keys, be able to do so based on, you know, knowing who's used that piece of software and plausibly generated keys with it. And then, yeah, mass revoke it and tell people to go and generate new ones. Like, that's a pretty good response. And seeing a response like that coordinated well is kind of nice because, I mean, you know, anyone could screw up crypto the first 15 times they implement it. You know, happens to all of us. But, yeah, actually dealing with it well seems good.
Yeah, we've got a bit of interesting research here, Adam, from Gel Vergier, I guess. I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, but this is about reverse engineering and decrypting CyberArk Vault credential files. And yeah, a little bit too achievable by the looks of things.
Yeah, so this is a good write-up of the encryption that's used by CyberArk to store credentials on disk. This is for an attacker that's gained access to some components of the CyberArk product and wants to steal credentials of it. So, you know, post-compromise, but still genuinely useful. I mean, being in a situation where you've compromised a Windows domain, where you have access to the operating systems that are running CyberArk and the CyberArk storing creds for other environments, or other things you don't necessarily have direct access to, and maybe it's hard to go hit the endpoints. Being able to steal all of the creds for everything off the CyberArk is a genuinely useful thing. And I know that, you know, we have done similar things with other centralized cred storage products. It's just a useful tool chain to have available. So yeah, this guy's done the research to figure out how the crypto works and released some Python tooling for doing so. So I think Red Team is probably the primary target for this. In CyberArk's defense, they have now updated it so that the default is to use the Windows DB API, which makes it a little more complicated than, you know, having the key material just in the files, which was the previous default.
Yeah. Makes sense. Oh, and another Catalan one. Again, 40% content by volume is Catalan Kimpanu stories. We've seen some more UEFI-based malware popping up in the wild, so it really does feel like this is a thing that exists now because this is not the first time. Like, I think they've got like 5 listed in this story that are out there now, and you really don't want your UEFI owned because it's, you know, eviction is more or less impossible, right? So I think we're going to see, this is probably, hey, we're getting late enough in the year that I can probably start throwing out some, 2022 predictions. And I would think UEFI, malware that leverages UEFI is going to be pretty more common next year for sure because it's way too useful.
It is way too useful. And this is, Catalan's story here is writing up research from ESET that are looking into a UEFI boot kit called eSpector, ESP-ECTA. And this one's interesting for a couple of reasons. So this is like number six of the sort of, you know, high quality UEFI rootkits that we've seen, you know, analyzed. This one's interesting because, one, it operates by kind of storing itself in a different part of the EFI. Like we've seen previous ones that kind of work by overriding the spy flash with replacement code. This involves like doing code injection into the EFI system partition. So kind of more similar to how a trad virus would do, you know, do take over the entry point, you know, of a PE or an ELF executable and you know, kind of run from there. So that part's interesting. Second thing is that they have lineage for this thing going back to 2012.
Yeah.
So this is potentially a, you know, almost 10-year-old kit that has been updated and previously only supported like Trad BIOS, now supports UEFI as well. There are a couple of Chinese language error strings in it, which, you know, as attribution goes, is not the most robust, but, you know, worth thinking about. And yeah, just kind of looks like a pretty high quality piece of tooling, you know, well supported, pretty stable. There hasn't been a whole lot of code changes over the years in the BIOS parts of it. So pretty robust and then is capable of loading a, you know, kernel component into Windows during boot. Then has a bunch of corresponding userland components that can steal data, steal screenshots, do keylogging, exfil them via a very kind of old school C2 process. So it does feel like old Chinese UEFI bootkits. So
yeah, it does. Yeah. And you're quite right. That list of five is stuff prior to this that they've talked about. But I guess, you know, imagine when ransomware crews, as part of their standard operating procedure, figure out a way to get into your UEFIs. Right.
Yes.
And then think, yeah. I want people to think about what eviction looks like at that point, because then it's really whack-a-mole. Right. And you will never win.
And at that point, you're probably going to be junking the hardware, right?
Which, if you can figure out which particular box it's on.
If you can even figure it out. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, UEFI is not the only place you can hide, right? There's so many embedded CPUs or embedded firmware, you know, video cards, network cards, you know, Thunderbolt option ROMs, you know, all the places that snare was hiding stuff back in the day. Like, there's so many great options.
But this is the point, right? Like, this is one of those things that we talk about in security. Someone demos it at a con, right? And then, you know, 10 years later, it's everywhere. It takes a while, but eventually it gets everywhere. And you just sort of think, oof, this would be a bad one to really take hold, because we don't really have much in the way of solutions here.
Well, I mean, there was that con talk where the guy ran Linux on his hard drive, like literally
on
the drive controller, and then was able to Trojan disk reads and writes as they went through the cache.
That was Mark Brand, who later worked at Project Zero for a while.
Yeah, well, he's certainly got plenty of experience in that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, the day that we see that in the wild, or that we discover it's been in the wild for 10 years like this, going to be a bad time.
But it's just when this stuff spreads to the crime gangs, that's when it's bad. And, you know, there's no word really on how this stuff got into the UEFI as well, which is a bit yikes emoji. because you don't know if they actually were able to do this through the OS or if they had physical access. Like, we just don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. And I think this one also, because of the way it does the infection, would break secure boot. So they would have had to either turn secure boot off in software or, you know, a lot of people have secure boot turned off, you know, depending on who they're targeting, especially if it's this going back this far. I mean, secure boot actually working on Windows, you know, that's like a Windows 8 and later thing. So, you know, given the age of this thing targeting Win 7 with this, that wouldn't have been an issue. But yeah, there are a number of techniques, and, you know, secure boot has one job. And we've seen, you know, with a number of stories in the last year or two about bugs in the secure enclaves and things that are required to support that whole process, that, it's not flawless.
Looks like Apple has squashed a really sweet LPE in iOS, and this one involved a kernel extension that allows developers to control how a device's memory handles the screen display. What's really interesting about this one is, thanks to an Israeli researcher by the name of Saar Amar, they diffed it and had POC up in like 12 hours, right? So that's amazing. But yeah, it looks like a pretty, I mean, pour one out, because that looks like a pretty sweet bug.
Yeah, this one was an integer overflow, talking to the frame buffer driver. So, yeah, pretty classic sort of bug. And, yeah, the write-up on that guy's blog is pretty solid. If you want to see what it looks like going from patch diff through to a crash. And then he's got some pointers for, you know, what you should think about if you are going to go and exploit. Because, like, that kind of class of attack of controlling memory allocations and stuff and turning that on into the coding. Like, that's been kind of discussed elsewhere, left as an exercise to the reader to actually go and work it up. But yeah, we also don't know how far back this bug went. So it was certainly late 14s and iOS 15.
Yeah. So there's probably someone weeping somewhere.
Someone weeping. Yes. About having their bugs wrecked. So it's good to see Apple wrecking some bugs. There's been a lot of salt about Apple's, you know, kind of bug handling on Twitter. So it's good to see them killing some bugs as well. It's just pissing off researchers.
Apache. We spoke about the Apache like path traversal bug. Looks like they've had to redo the patch. I mean, let's not be mean to them, right? Like, this stuff isn't necessarily trivially easy, but yeah, they did not successfully patch their path traversal bug.
No, they didn't. And the way that they didn't successfully patch it was like Unicode URI. So they had a URI encoding bug in
Could have seen that coming? Who could have guessed?
Right? And so, yeah, they failed to take into account the Unicode variants. And, yeah, like, this is IIS bugs from the early 2000s back to haunt Apache.
But this is a whole generation of people who are probably doing the maintenance now who weren't around for that, right?
So probably right, you know, that there has been, you know, enough time has passed. But, I mean, the good news is that this bug was only in very, very recent Apache. The downside is probably a bunch of people upgraded to the second vulnerable version of Apache because of the previous one. So it may be like, maybe the second bug has more impact than the first one because there's more people running it now. So yeah, it's a bit of a mess. And
I'm surprised they didn't test it against Unicode. I'll admit to being a little bit surprised by that. Yeah. But again, you know, I guess, you know, just new people, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's open source software, and, you know, probably the people who do this in their spare time.
Oh, I'm guessing Apache's well funded. I mean, come on, man.
Well, you think so, but I mean, yeah, I don't know whether the people who work the Apache security team and patches and stuff are, you know, get paid for it or not. But we do expect a lot of open source maintainers.
We do.
Is what I'm saying.
We do. No, 100%. And, you know, having briefly worked with a maintainer of an open source project for a while, it is pretty amazing how entitled users are, where you give them the thing for free and they yell at you, basically.
Exactly.
Is the open source dynamic. But Adam, that is it for this week's news. And, of course, I'm off for a couple of weeks. I need to sleep train our 6-month-old baby. So, 2 weeks of semi-downtime where I'm just going to focus on the newsletter and, you know, admin and all that sort of stuff, but no show. So we'll chat again in 3 weeks and I'll look forward to it.
Yeah, it will be nice to have a break and, we'll see what terrible things happen. It's always exciting when you take a week off or a couple of weeks off and watch the internet burn. It's our favourite thing. So, yeah, I'll look forward to it. See you in 3 weeks.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsored review now with Jonathan Reiber from Attack IQ. Jonathan is a senior director of cybersecurity at Attack IQ, but prior to joining the company, he had 6 years' experience working for the US government's Office of the Secretary of Defense. He's also done other private sector gigs, like working for Illumio. He was involved with IST too, which is that organization that put out that ransomware paper a while back, the good one. But the point is, Jonathan works in the private sector now, but he has really deep contacts within the sort of US government cyber defense establishment, the cyber circles, if you will. Now, Attack IQ makes a breach and attack simulation platform, and they say they can validate various components of Zero Trust architectures. So I thought I'd get Jonathan on to talk more broadly about Zero Trust, and in particular, the Biden White House's May executive order around Zero Trust. That order basically instructed federal government agencies to draw up plans for a migration to a Zero Trust architecture and then get cracking on those plans. So here is Jonathan talking about what the reaction to that executive order was in his circles and how he thinks the big US government transition to Zero Trust will go. Here's Jonathan Reiber.
I think when it came out, Chase Cunningham, who'd spent the last like 10 years or 5 years at least of his life like advocating for Zero Trust, he calls himself Dr. Zero Trust. And John Kindervag, who's the founder of Zero Trust, who was at Palo Alto, like, it was a great celebratory day for these folks who've been toiling away, right? To say, like, look, this thing has come out, it's validated, no pun intended, the concepts that you've articulated, because people began to understand that they had to segment their networks and prevent this kind of movement. So it's a great thing that they did this. I will say there is still some confusion around what zero trust is, as you and I like are very aware, right? But like the National Security Agency wrote a beautiful memo about zero trust in February that CISA was circulating within the government at that time, that came out just in time to sort of be the explanatory document for the US government before, in advance of the EO. And I've never asked anybody in government if these two things was done in that order for that particular reason. I tend to think the NSA memo came out first. I think it's great. I mean, there are those who say that zero trust is just a marketing concept. And I like to push back on them and say, well, have you looked into application dependency mapping? Do you have any sense of like, do organizations actually have any sense of what their applications even are and how well connected they are? And the answer is most often no. So there's a lot of education that's going on around this concept. And I think it's tremendous that the administration adopted it. The question is then delivery, right? Like implementation, moving these agencies, getting them to spend money on what they have to spend money on is not an easy job. And yeah. I think it falls to Chris Inglis and Jen Easterly to sort of bang their fists on the table. And with Chris Inglis now as the National Cyber Director, with like congressional authority granted to him to be able to drive change within the government, I'm hopeful that he'll be able to force change.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but just recently there was a news story carried by Vice that said, the intelligence community is blocking ads on its, on its networks, right, as a security measure. And, it was a good piece, but I think it was Rob Joyce who pointed out that NSA actually made that recommendation to agencies in 2019. So I think the surprising thing about that news story was that the IC managed to implement that control on its networks within a 2-year time frame. But zero trust is a more ambitious shift, right? So I'm curious, and you've been on the inside of this sausage factory, right? So I'm curious to know how you think it's going to go, because I just don't know what it's going to look like in a couple of years, right? When you pass down such a sort of fundamental mandate, right, to government agencies, they're not really known for being able to re-architect stuff quickly. Are you getting any feedback already from people you know about how this EO is translating into, action plans?
I will ask that question, but first, let me flip it a little bit. We wrote a book in, 2018, 2019, called Secure Beyond Breach, which was a title that I loved, actually. The idea that, like, if you assume breach, you know the intruder's going to get in, you have to make yourself secure beyond it. And one of the great things I learned in the writing of that process, working with Matt Glenn, who is the SVP for product at Illumio, was that you have to bring people along for segmentation, which is the thing that I'm, like, most closely aligned to from a zero trust standpoint. Because it is a transformation of how business is done, and it does change business. That's so. In a 2018 mindset, coming out of the Russia intrusion on the election was the most galvanizing moment in cybersecurity history. The inertia that he articulated back then feels to me far less weighty in a 2021 mindset because of Colonial Pipeline and SolarWinds. Because I think we've gotten to the point now where in cybersecurity, people are like, wow, nothing has worked. Like our approach for security, there's something fundamentally wrong about how we're going about cybersecurity. And it's one of two things. One, psychologically, leaders and agencies and organizations and companies simply haven't woken up to it. That problem has now changed, right? I would argue. Two, if they have woken up to it, I think they're now willing and able to say, I'm ready to make the investments that are required to secure the world that we live in, because it hasn't worked so far and we have to make an element of change. Now, if you look at like the successes of zero trust providers in the last 4 or 5 years coming out of the valley, like banks, which are traditionally far more nimble and have much more at stake than other agencies or other organizations, banks have so much on the line with e-commerce and the transition of financial information. They're the early adopters of zero trust. So the banks have succeeded in this way. And so they've proven the validity of the technology. And I think that's incredibly important for government agencies. Now, you look at Jen Easterly, who's formerly at Morgan Stanley, right? She's been there for a while. She's coming in. She's now seen what an organization can do if there's enough will to adopt change.
So now, this is really interesting what you're saying, right? Because it's almost like there's this realization that we've got to try something different here, right? And this is, you know, zero trust thinking is sufficiently different from Windows AD networks doing everything kind of the same and getting owned sideways, right? So you believe that there has been a sort of sea change in the mindset and the government realizes that something radical kind of needs to be done.
And I think it's really interesting. Like, I haven't talked to Jen recently about this, so I'm not speaking out of school. But I think it's really interesting, the idea that you can have a cybersecurity leader who succeeds tremendously in the government. When she was in the Obama White House running counterterrorism, senior director for, I think it was counterterrorism, she goes and she does this incredible thing working in the private sector for X number of years and then comes back. She's now in a position, like, the field has matured, technologies have matured, and she's learned these incredible things working for one of the world's biggest investment banks. She can now say and bring lessons from what she's learned into the government. I'm completely speculating.
But I think also what you say there is funny, right? Because you're talking about it maturing. I think technology generally has matured, because for those of us who've been around long enough, you know, in the early days when companies realized they needed senior leadership for IT roles, forget about just security, IT, they'd pick one smart person who had an MBA and they'd put him in that role, right? So that was the first generation of sort of executive tech leadership within enterprise and government. And I think what's changed is the IT discipline's been, you know, matured to the point and has been big enough for long enough that we're seeing people come into management roles who actually do have technical experience and a deeper understanding of technology. So, and I think that's particularly true in government, right? Where you would have a lot of people come up through the public service who weren't necessarily that knowledgeable on technology, right? So do you think it's that shift in the sort of expert level, like the technical expert level of cybersecurity executives within government that's largely going to make this hopefully not a shit show?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've gone on the record a number of times sort of praising folks that have grown up in the field that are now running the show. The person I've spoken to the most and the person that I've known the longest and the best is General Paul Nakasone, right? I've known him since he was a colonel. And I was Jim Miller's special assistant back when, like, I literally knew very little about cybersecurity, right? And he and I made friends back then, and I've seen him, like, grow up through the ranks. And most of us knew early on that he was going to become the head of U.S. Cyber Command because he possessed the kind of leadership that you'd want to see in an Army officer, but he also possessed the kind of technical competency. And now it's interesting. It's like we have enough historical events that the American public, I think, like previously it was like I would take phone calls when a breach would happen because people were asking me to explain to them how important something was, right? With Colonial Pipeline, I got messages, people sending me stuff, but they weren't asking. They were more like, oh my God, did you see this? And the fact is with Colonial Pipeline, and somebody in the government told me that, like, for the first time in this person's experience, there was another element of the national security architecture that was brought into the conversation, and that was the energy resiliency component. And that to me is like an alignment that we've long anticipated this kind of attack happening, and we've been planning for it since the very beginning of US Cyber Command. But to actually see the machinery working and to see the market change a little bit after the intrusion indicates to me that the American public will get it. The question is, can leaders in institutions across the country adopt the practices that matter most? And that says to me, like, we actually need good, memorable phrases, which I want to say this again, you know, in honor of Ronald Reagan, who, like, said, remember, he said, trust but verify in relation to nuclear arms control agreements, because he would broker an agreement with Gorbachev, but then he would want the inspectors to go and check that the agreement was being met. And the same thing, I would urge the Biden administration to say, look, you've launched zero trust, but validate. You have to make sure that the investments that you're doing actually work. Otherwise, you're simply talking and you're simply spending money. But if you're actually adopting the exercise framework, then you're getting into a much better position. I don't want Don Rumsfeld to be the last person that we have, like, a memorable national security aphorism between known unknowns, known knowns, and unknown knowns.
That one is actually programmed into my soundboard. All right, Jonathan Reiber, thank you so much for joining us to have that conversation about, you know, the shift to zero trust and why we should trust but verify. It's been great to have you.
Trust but validate.
There you go. It's been great to have you. Cheers.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Jonathan Reiber there from Attack IQ with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Attack IQ for being our sponsor this week. You can find them at attackiq.com. And that is it from me this week. There will not be a weekly show, as you heard when we signed off the news. There won't be a weekly show running next week or the week after, but I will be publishing an hour-long interview I recorded with Mark Dowd. I'll be doing that next week, so do check that one out. He'll be talking about the zero-day market and the future of offensive security and exceptional access. It is a great conversation, so do not miss it. A couple weeks off for me, and then I'll be back. So until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.